from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I've been around here for a few years, and this issue has been around as almost as long as I have. And I have been fighting it for most of my career. But I am here to say that I am no longer fighting it, but I am supporting Tobacco 21 for the state of Illinois. We cannot no longer ignore this, stick our head in the sand, and I think this is the right thing to do on many levels. And the thing is, I also did the research, but I looked at my greatest resource to make this determination, and that would be my daughter, Caroline, who's 17 years old at Lyons Township High School in LaGrange, Illinois, told me, "Dad, it's out of control. Not just tobaccos, but also Juuls, e-cigarettes, and all those that go along with it." She said, "You guys need to do something." And I said, "Caroline, I'm doing something. I'm changing my mind, and I will be voting for this bill. And I recommend everyone else to support this legislation."
If we care about closing the pay gap in this state, this is the first step to doing that. This is a very long time in coming.
The entire disparity in wages for women and men in the state of Illinois will not be reduced by this bill. This is just one little tool. Many of the reasons for that disparity are much more deeply rooted than simply asking a female applicant for her past history.
State Representatives Anna Moeller and Margot McDermott, they're on opposite sides of legislation to prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their salary history. That's intended to decrease the wage gap between men and women for doing the same work, and that bill did pass the House this week, also passing both the House and Senate, going to the governor. Tobacco 21, we heard House Republican leader Jim Durkin explaining why he changed his mind, deciding to support that legislation. That's just some of what we'll talk about this week on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor, and Jacqueline Driscoll, IPR Reporter, with us as well. Jacqueline, Tobacco 21, this is legislation that's been watched for a while. It's passed the legislature before. Governor Rauner vetoed this. This would raise the age for people to purchase tobacco products, including those vaping devices and such. Finally, it made it through, and we still don't know exactly where Governor Pritzker stands, but that'll be what we'll watch next.
Right. We've asked his administration very pointed questions, if he has seen the legislation, if he has any particular issues with it. We did hear from Republicans. Obviously, there is a tax money issue. They're saying we're going to lose out on some tax dollars if we do raise that purchasing age up to 21. But also, this bill removes the penalties for minors who are caught in possession of tobacco. And they're basically saying, well, look, now we're giving them, the legal opportunity to have tobacco and not have any penalties. However, the Democrats who are supporting this measure say they want to shift the blame from the younger kids, teens, who do have these tobacco products or vaping devices, and shift the blame to the businesses who are selling it to them.
Charlie, it was interesting to hear Jim Durkin at the start saying, he had been an opponent of this before, and I think maybe he had been in that mindset of, if you're old enough to be going into the military at 18, you should be allowed to smoke if that's what you decide to do. He said he's changed his mind after talking with his daughter.
Yeah, and I commend him for that, because it's not something that parents of teenagers are always inclined to do, pay attention to what their kids are saying. But his daughter, Caroline, obviously has a much better picture of what's going on in high school, at least in the suburbs, than he would or any of us on this panel would. And so if she sees it as a problem, well, that means that it is something that we probably ought to address. Part of the Republican argument is that it's going to have a bad impact, particularly along the state's borders, where younger people will just go to Indiana, go to Missouri, go to Iowa or Wisconsin to buy cigarettes. If they can't do them here, they'll go to some convenience store across the state line, and they'll not only buy cigarettes, they'll buy a bunch of other stuff. I don't know if that's really a valid argument or not, because I suspect that at some point, the notion of having to be 21 to use tobacco products will be pretty well accepted, not just in Illinois, but everywhere else, because there's definite scientific research and study that shows if you start smoking at a very young age, it's harder to quit the habit later on, and everybody knows smoking is not good for your health. Now, I'm of a generation when smoking was considered to be healthy. There were ads where guys in white coats will say, "Are you nervous? I have a Camel." And I had classmates when I was in grade school who started smoking when they were in third grade. But we know a lot better now, and I believe we should take steps to make it harder for young people to get hooked on this stuff.
And Brian, it's been like 50 years now and since the warning labels went on to cigarette packs, things like that. And we have seen a huge drop in the number of people who actually smoke cigarettes. And what we're seeing now apparently is a rise in these other types of devices that that are gaining popularity, especially among young people. That's what this is targeted at.
Yeah, and it's not, it's anecdotal data that Leader Durkin was citing on the floor there from his daughter, but the Food and Drug Administration just within the last month or so put out information from the National Youth Tobacco Survey. They call it a startling reversal of declines in tobacco use among young people. So in terms of e-cigarettes, in 2017, it was 11.7% were using it, and then that jumped up to 20%. In 2018. That's a 78% increase. That's a lot of numbers I'm throwing out there. But, you know, there's a difference between adults and kids with these products. For adults, there is some evidence that switching to e-cigarettes, while it's not harmless, it is probably better than inhaling the combustible smoke of burning tobacco leaves. There is still an addictive chemical, though, nicotine. And for young people, there's a concern that you start down this road and then you will eventually need the greater fix that comes from traditional cigarettes or some other sort of tobacco product, the kind of gateway argument. So this is something that lung advocates, anti-cancer advocates, health advocates have been pushing for a long time. And as we said, the question is now whether Governor Pritzker, you know, supports the concept. Maybe he didn't quite even go that far, but he does talk about it. You know, he has said he doesn't want his own kids to start using e-cigarettes. But he is also proposing to help balance the budget by taxing e-cigarettes and by raising the tax on tobacco products. So he is remaining coy on this issue. And, you know, as we said earlier, there's also this in this legislation targeting the retailers as opposed to the kids. There's that business argument against this particular approach. So it'll be interesting to see where the governor comes down.
Well, let's move on to another piece of legislation we mentioned there at the start of the show, what's being known as this gender pay equity legislation, not being able to ask a prospective employee about a job applicant about their past salary history. So who can tell me what that's all about?
Well, this would essentially prohibit employers from asking about previous salaries. If anybody's recently applied for a job, some job applications would require the applicants to disclose their previous salary. This is intended primarily to help women and minorities. Some argue that this helps, this no longer perpetuates the issue of paying people less money for the same jobs. It's interesting to note that this is the third attempt at passing this. It did pass the House. It had passed twice recently, and it was vetoed twice.
I'm guessing that business groups are opposed to this.
You know, the Republicans, a lot of Republicans were making an argument that this is not the right approach. This should be part of a package, that this is not doing enough, that they have other ideas for reforms that they want to put in this area. So, there was some opposition. Governor Rauner vetoed it, obviously. He favored it, and I'm forgetting now which state, but there was another state that has a different model for trying to prevent this that he was advocating. But it's a new day. This is, I think, again, I'm trying to remember, Jacqueline, if the governor said where he stands on this particular piece of legislation. I know when Representative Mueller presented it on the floor, she said that she thought the governor was going to sign it. And he did sign an executive order saying that state agencies could no longer ask for salary history when they're vetting applicants for jobs.
Also, we discussed there a little bit earlier, we're talking about the tobacco, the vaping, and that the governor is looking at some taxes on that. The governor has proposed a few different ideas to raise money in this year's budget, this upcoming year's budget. And Jacqueline, we've been working on some stories regarding that. we'll leave the tobacco one since we know what that's about out of this. But one of the things that has come up, of course, was gambling. He wants to see some expansion of gambling. He also wants to see cannabis legalized, recreational use of it and taxed. Those are the types of things he's aiming at.
Right. And gambling and recreational cannabis are very similar in the sense that they're maybe a bit optimistic because they're programs that I might go as far as classifying them as complex, right? There's a lot of things that go into them, and they haven't passed. We actually haven't even seen a bill, or we've seen a recreational cannabis bill sponsored by Carol Ammons, but the bill that's been worked on by Senator Staines and Representative Kelly Cassidy, both Democrats of Chicago, that hasn't been finalized yet. So there's a lot of details still up in the air. We don't know how they're going to structure the tax system for either gambling or recreational cannabis, how much money the state will get from it. You know, it relies heavily on how the law is written, where the tax money will go, how it will be taxed. Right now, we've seen a few details coming out of the budget proposals from Governor Pritzker. He did say for gambling, he would like to see around $10 million for a license and about $5,000 to renew every year. And for recreational cannabis, he'd like to see licenses come in at about $100,000.
Charlie, the argument on these is really the same in some respects, and that is it's going on now. There's sort of a black market. People can gamble in different ways, but the state doesn't see any revenue from it. Same for cannabis. Is that a legitimate argument to make?
Yeah, I think it is, particularly in the idea of having sports betting legalized. This coming Sunday is going to be Selection Sunday, when the NCAA will say who are the teams that are going to be in the men's basketball tournament. And probably, I forget the exact number, but hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, are going to be wagered, all of it illegally.
Office pools, things
office
like that.
Office pools, yeah, and even at a higher level, outside from a few states in Nevada, if you want to wager with a bookie, that's illegal too. And so that's a market that could be tapped, and that would raise a lot of money, I think. On the other hand, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, the legislature's bipartisan revenue projecting entity, in its report last fall, said that expanding gambling probably, with what we have now with casinos, adding casinos, adding slots at racetracks, that kind of thing, is not going to be a large recurring source of revenue. There'll be a big hit when we sell the licenses. But because there's so much gaming already with the video terminals, the bump up in revenues on an annual basis is going to be pretty small.
Well, a lot of folks, I say, would not be into gambling, and a lot of people won't be buying into marijuana if it even if it does become legal. But one thing that the governor has proposed that I think would hit a lot of folks, and maybe something they're not quite aware of, is what's being called a bag tax. Brian, you've reported on that. Can you explain it?
Yeah, this is something that environmentalists have wanted to see for a long time. City of Chicago has had it for a couple of years. This is intended to sort of nudge people, or I guess technically an incentive, if you want, incentivize people to not use plastic or even paper bags when they go shopping, whether it's the grocery store or a clothing store or wherever. The idea is that if you want one of those bags, you're going to be charged for it. Governor Pritzker, in his budget address, called for a nickel tax. City of Chicago has 7 cents. Environmentalists would like to see it even higher, 10 cents a bag, to really discourage the use. And that's one of the big questions, is how much would this bag tax be if it was going to be passed? The other big question is what do you do with the money? So in Chicago, the money is divvied up. The actual store gets to keep 2 cents. The Illinois Retail Merchants Association says that's important because they have to stock extra products, reusable bags that they have to carry, and you know, do paperwork or computer work or whatever to administer this tax and remit the money. And then the rest goes to the city of Chicago. In the state model, Governor Pritzker just had 5 cents, it would all go into the state's main checking account, the general revenue fund. Environmentalists don't like that idea because they're worried that if the state comes to like this as a source of revenue, they're not going to be too interested in actually discouraging the use of plastic bags, which they say is terrible for the environment. Not only does it create litter, but once these things break down, they actually get into our water supply and eventually can work their way into the animals we eat and into us. And they want to see the money used for more environmental causes. So this is it's a very small piece of Governor Pritzker's budget proposal. Anywhere from $19 to $23 million is what his budget office projected the state would collect, which is, you know, basically a rounding error when you're talking about a state budget, the general revenue budget anyway, that's, you know, getting close to $40 billion.
Brian, a lot of people always say that the sales tax is regressive because, of course, people who don't make a lot of money still have to buy things. People who may fail to bring these bags along with them, they're going to get hit with this tax as well, I would guess. And has that argument been brought up also?
It has, although I think, you know, there are a number of groups that have set up, particularly in lower income areas, like free bag giveaways, for example. So this is something that, and I think if anyone shops at Aldi, which is kind of a discount grocery chain, they charge for bags. So I think there is evidence that, you know, and we saw in Chicago, based on the data, that people do actually change their behavior when these things happen. So yes, if people are not remembering to bring their own bag, then they would be hit with this tax. On the other hand, there's evidence that the number of people who just don't take a bag doubled. And in fact, one legislator I talked to said she'll just stuff in her purse or carry it out in her hands from the store, which, you know, we should say there's a, you know, this is not something that has universal approval. There's a Republican I talked to, Representative Alan Skillicorn from the suburbs, who thinks it's kind of ridiculous that the state is trying to engineer behavior. He said, you know, he uses reusable bags, but he just doesn't think it should be the law, something where the state is using this particular tax incentive to change behavior. Of course, and whether it's marriage or child tax credit, the state does use a lot of tax policy to try and influence behavior.
And I saw an interesting comment online. Someone was saying, without these plastic bags, how do we pick up after our dogs?
Yeah. Good idea there. So Charlie's always looking at the other angles to this. But before I leave this revenue discussion of what's in the governor's budget plan, we also reported on something called an MCO tax. And Jacqueline, you can explain that for us, I guess.
Well, kind of, yeah. It's a very complex issue. It's the largest portion of his revenue part of the proposal. $390 million is what Pritzker is projecting that it will bring in. First, I want to kind of break down what an MCO is, because it's a little bit confusing as I try to dive into this. They're essentially insurance providers, and under Medicaid managed care, the state pays the organization for Medicaid payments, and then they provide the coverage. So they're kind of like the middleman managing the money there. So what Pritzker has said is he would like to tax these MCO providers, but health insurance experts say there's no real way to do this without taxing every single insurer, private insurers included, and they argue that this tax is then going to get passed on to employers and employees, the regular people like you and I. We're going to have to pay for this higher premiums, or essentially we're just going to have to be the ones making up for this tax. However, Representative Greg Harris, who has been working on proposals for years, pretty much saying the same thing. He's a Democrat from Chicago. He's a leader in the House. He says, we've already put it into the legislation that it's going to prohibit insurance companies from passing this tax on to consumers. So insurers will just have to eat that tax, the insurance companies. So it's a very complex issue, and we'll see where it goes.
I smell a lot of lobbying.
What I see is one of the benefits of this, it's patterned after two existing fees we have in other areas of healthcare. For example, hospitals pay a bed tax, nursing homes also pay a tax, and it's based on occupancy. Mm-hmm. And that money then is used to pay for these services, which gets us, for Medicaid recipients, which gets us a match from the federal government. So for every dollar we spend, we get 50 cents back. And so I can see this working out where the deal would be, yeah, we're going to tax you, but we're going to use some of that money that we get from the feds, the excess dollars that we're getting through kind of laundering it through the system. We're going to use that to kind of raise what you're getting, your rates. There's also a lot of consternation about the fact that these managed care organizations are not very transparent in terms of what they do with the funds they receive. So I can see a deal being worked out where they're more open with what they're doing, but they also get a little higher payback based on the additional federal dollars that we're going to get. That's right. Kind of how it works with the hospitals and nursing homes.
That's exactly what Governor Pritzker's administration had said. This is a way essentially to draw down more federal dollars to come back and put more money into the Medicaid program. As Charlie mentioned, MCOs not being transparent. In reporting this, I found that hospitals, especially safety net hospitals, whose primary clients are people on Medicaid, are not happy with the MCOs. They're saying that they're denying claims, or they're just taking a very long time to pay these claims. So they would actually like to see the federal dollars not go back to the MCOs, and they have a better idea for the funds and coming back to them and actually making sure that they can take care of their patients.
And Charlie, what's the difference between those and what we've always heard about HMOs through the years? Is it just basically the clientele that they deal with?
Well, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
In terms of the argument for it is that the United States system for years has been based on taking care of people when they're sick. And so I go to the doctor when I'm sick. My insurance company pays for most of it. In a lot of other countries, there's an emphasis on preventative care that If you would eat better, exercise more, then you wouldn't be sick. And so that's what the managed care operation is supposed to do. The theory being that we'll pay the company a flat sum to take care of Wheeler's medical needs. And the company, if they manage to get Wheeler to exercise more, will save money and they get to keep that money. On the other hand, if Wheeler keeps being a slug, and requires all these services, then they'll have to eat the excess. That's the theory. It'll be an incentive for people to keep themselves healthier. The concern on the other side is that because a lot of these are for-profit operations, they'll say, well, you don't really need to get your teeth cleaned twice a year. You can do it every 5 years, mm-hmm. and we'll pocket the difference, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a difference between is it managed care or is it managed cost?
Right.
And what is the company putting first, the care or the cost?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Brian, before we run out of time this week, I want to save a couple of minutes here to talk about some pension hearings that have gotten underway at the Capitol. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is a series of hearings. This is kind of an endless issue because it's a large dollar figure over time that Illinois is on the hook for that it does not have. And it is, in the more near term, it is a share of the state's budget that keeps growing every year. More and more money is, based on the statutes and following the scheme that was devised in the mid-1990s, the state is having to put more and more money towards its pensions every year. Part of this is because of actuarial problems. But anyway, there's a series of hearings that's going to happen this year as legislators try once again to deal with this situation. And the first one had to do with Tier 2 pensions. This is the state pension system for anyone who started their first job with the state after 2011. And it's a lower benefit amount. And this is something we've heard about bubbling up, that there are some problems with this. One is the Social Security safe harbor provision, and this was kind of the new news, I thought, out of this hearing this week. The idea is that the Social Security, like a lot of teachers, people who work for universities, us, I think, all of us on this panel today, are not participants in the U.S. federal Social Security program through our job, because there's a provision in that as long as the government entity or whatever employer provides at least a retirement benefit that exceeds the value or meets or exceeds the value of Social Security, then they don't also have to contribute to Social Security. Well, the problem is for Tier 2 pension benefits, they're thought of as probably not good enough to match Social Security. Now, that determination is made when people leave. The actuaries at TRS, the Teachers Retirement System, have crunched these numbers. And originally the thought was, well, this could be something we're going to have to deal with in 2035. Well, then a few years ago, they re-looked at the numbers, and then it was 2027. And now there's a preliminary report. They're still working on it, so they weren't ready to say for sure. But they think that that date is going to be even sooner when there's a reckoning. And what this means is when it happens, the state, or I should say it's not the state, actually, the state and TRS are not on the hooks. All these local school districts are going to have to go back and retroactively pay the Social Security tax for these employees whose retirement benefits are not good enough. And that is going to be, you know, we certainly hear a lot of people complaining about property taxes in the state legislature all over the state. That is something that is really going to be a big cost burden for a lot of schools if this comes to pass the way people are predicting it will.
Brian, only about 30 seconds here or so, but I know this is just sort of the start of these hearings and the discussion point, but is there some type of plan that's being bandied about as a way to possibly stave some of this off?
I mean, Governor Pritzker has put out a plan to try and shore up funding of the pensions, and this is part of a broader package. I mentioned the teachers. There were also firefighters, conservation police officers have a unique situation that they're in. And some of the union reps for these groups say that the Tier 2 pension system was put together so kind of hastily and slapdash in a manner that there were just drafting errors and oversights that have really negatively affected, you know, relatively small groups of employees like conservation police officers. So this is something that they're working on a broader package of legislation for later this spring.
Okay. Go for our notes from the field now. And Charlie, we'll start with you.
Well, Comptroller Susana Mendoza released her debt transparency report. This is a summary that she puts together every month and puts out saying, here's how much the state has in bill backlogs. And the one that came out at the end of February, which was for the end of February, which was just released last week, showed that our general fund's bill backlog at the end of February was $8.6 billion. Now, the backlog today, as of Friday morning, was $8.2 billion. So we're in that $8.5 billion range, and we have been for a while, and it's roughly 140,000 bills stacked up.
Okay. Jacqueline?
The Senate could soon take up a measure that would require K through 12 public schools in Illinois to begin teaching LGBT history. That did pass the House this week with just enough votes that it needed, 60 yes and 42 nay. The measure would require textbooks to include, according to the bill, roles and contributions of people protected under the Illinois Human Rights Act. So could be seeing some new history books in public schools.
Okay. And Brian?
Yeah, our colleague Dana Vollmer was at the Illinois Supreme Court this week for an interesting case out of the city of Chicago, which has a 5-cent water bottle tax. It's not supposed to apply to sparkling waters, Perrier, that sort of thing, flavored waters, but Walgreens was charging customers for the tax anyway. And now there's a class action lawsuit. They say, we want our tax money back. The money's already gone to the city, so Walgreens says, we don't have the money anymore. And they say, you know, you should have challenged this, looked at your receipt, seen the tax when you bought your Perrier, and challenged it at the time. I'll leave it to the listener to decide whether how you think that conversation would go, arguing tax law with the person behind the cash register at Walgreens. But this is something that the Illinois Supreme Court will be deciding in the coming months.
Okay. Members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Jacqueline Driscoll. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.